So welcome to the West Coast Project Podcast. This is the episode 2 of True Detective that we're talking about. And this is a real-time interpretation, so if you haven't seen these episodes yet, turn it off right now. So by real-time interpretation, we mean we can talk about anything we know, and we are now on March 5th after I've seen the 7th episode. I think you probably have, right, Michelle?
I have.
So Michelle and I are talking about episode 2, and this is an interpretation of episode 2. It's not really a recap, or it's not really... We'll talk about what's going on, but I'm more interested in the interpretation.
Okay. Yeah.
And this is after I tried to do episode 1. I did episode 1 the day before I went on this long road trip, and I was like up all day, and it was late, and I was like super tired. So I did like this... I listened to it. It was really a tired-sounding 10-minute podcast.
I think you're too hard on yourself. I don't think so. I thought you did really good and brought up a lot of good points in it.
All right. Well, I'm awake tonight, so.
Okay, good.
So this episode's called Seeing Things, and I had to go back and watch it. I did not remember enough to just, like, go off the top of my head, you know, weeks later. So I went back and watched it, and... kind of jotted down some notes, but we're still at this point, I think we're still trying to figure out if Rust is the murderer, if Hart's the murderer, or if they're both in...
Well, I thought it was even hard to tell at this point in the second episode if which one they were maybe pinpointing. At this point, I even thought that it might be Hart that they were looking for in place of Cole when I went into episode 2. And then it didn't look like that as the episode kind of unfolded. It looked more like they were looking at Cole. And but it was hard to tell from the questions that they were asking, I think, in episode 1. And then in episode 2, it seemed like they were really focusing on Cole a whole lot more, asking about his the way he handled the ritualistic murder, which of course is the main thing that we're talking about in the whole podcast, is this one particular ritualistic murder. And they really seem to focus more in the present day on how Cole handled the investigation over what happened in the actual in the actual findings, I think.
So why do you think the writer wrote this story? What do you think his motivation was?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's like you and I have discussed before about the book and stuff. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they've if it was just a really good murder mystery or if it's something a little darker. Because see, we've not finished it yet either. So we're not done yet. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, Mark? I don't think we need to be done to figure out. I don't think it's a murder mystery. I think the murder mystery is a vehicle for the author to tell a greater story. And I kind of hinted at it in my first podcast. I think it's a story. It's an investigation of, like, people. Like, it, you know, they're exploring life and how people view life and family and... And maybe down deeper, just individually, how people view life and what things around them mean to them. And the murder mystery is just a vehicle to carry us on that journey.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I see, too, though, that they're trying to... The investigators in the present are trying to figure out something about the past that I don't think we know yet. Although we know a lot, but I don't think we know yet. There's been another murder, and it's similar to the murder before, and we've put away somebody for the murder before, so we don't understand how this could have happened at this point. And so that's the premise behind, anyway, why they're investigating these two investigators that investigated this crime back then. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, so it kind of starts out, Russ says he's not sleeping, and he's thinking about women. He's thinking about his wife and his daughter. You know, here I am kind of looking at, like, what's driving him as a person more than what he's going after as far as trying to pursue this case.
Well, right, and he speaks several times about his insomnia, and how he hasn't slept in a long, long time. But I think in part of that they're also sort of bringing out parts of his personality. He was smoking and drinking in these interviews in present day, and I think that kind of shows that he is drinking again. He says it in this episode. It just kind of reveals parts of him, I think, a little bit at a time, and I think it's done brilliantly.
How do you watch the show, Michelle? Do you watch the show and just interpret your own thoughts, or do you check out any podcasts, or do you read any articles or Reddit or anything else about the show?
I have read nothing else about it. The podcasts, I haven't been able to get into yet for some reason. So, no, this is all me.
Well, they say some things about Cole and his beer drinking. First of all, he's on his third beer at this point, his third Lone Star Tall Boy. But there's a lot of conjecture on the people that investigate the show and like kind of philosophize about what's going on, that Cole asked for beer from these detectives so his whatever he said would not be admissible, or at least it would put up another wall of preventing whatever he said or slipped or, you know, got whatever got through to these two detectives, that it wouldn't be admissible because he was intoxicated. And he also made it such that they actually went and got him the beer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So he put up a little bit of a firewall in protecting himself from anything that might slip through in this interview.
But they ask him at one point in the interview when he was talking about his visions that he used to have, and I know we're really not even close to there yet, but they ask him about that. They ask if he still had visions and if he were really trying to hide something, if he really wanted to make it where he would have something that was inadmissible, wouldn't he say maybe that he still has visions of things, or even say that he was never really able to tell his visions from his reality, but he could, according to him. He always knew the difference in the visions. Back in 1995, when he was investigating this, he was having these different visions, and they show that in the show.
Yeah.
And I think that he specifically talks about how much better he is now.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because he's very often, he's brutally honest with these two guys, and he's also, at other times, he's like really deceptively and brilliantly deceptive in keeping them from the truth. But sometimes he's pretty honest. Like, he tells them exactly what he's thinking. Like, he describes the spiral of the birds and the hallucinations, like you said.
Well, right, and he's vague, but I think his personality is vague. Have you ever met anybody like that? Their personality is just vague, and that's what I'm gathering from him.
Yeah, but he's after something. He's interviewing them way more than they're interviewing him.
I think he's brilliant. He's really sharp, so I don't disagree with that at all. But I'm just saying that if that were true, that he was trying to set up a scenario where he couldn't be held accountable for anything he says, I think he would be much more adept at doing that. He has many circumstances that he could add things in place of just the beer. You know, free beer.
So, we have the freedom to know, to have the knowledge of episode 7, looking back at this episode 2. Is there anything you want to interpret from things you know from 5 or 6 episodes later than what you saw in episode 2?
Oh my gosh. You know, I wasn't sure how we were going to do this and talk about this. So I really tried to keep it just on episode 2. So we wouldn't.
No, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. We're interpreting what we know. So,
okay.
So what I thought of was that he talked about Andrew and Hurricane Andrew, and Rust grills the two detectives. The two detectives, by the way, are Gilbaugh and Papania, and I'm just going to call them G&B or G&P because it's easier. But Rust turns the tables and he grills them about Hurricane Andrew. Like, why did the school close after Hurricane Andrew? The school that this Tuttle guy ran.
Right.
And we learned in episode 7 or 6 or 7, I can't remember which, but Rust goes into one of his philosophical rants, and he's like, Hurricane Andrew, everybody's lost, everybody's displaced, nobody knows where anything is. It's the perfect time for this crazy murderous, you know, setting to happen. So back in episode two here, where we're discussing tonight, he asked them about Hurricane Andrew and what they knew about Andrew.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's smart. I didn't think about that, honestly. It's 92. August of 92. So it was a good little while before this happened. But I thought it was interesting how they were bringing out the various personalities and the different people. Even Dora Lange, which is the victim, her mother. Remember when they went to her mother's house and they were talking to her, and I thought it was time. She was talking about how she had seen this on the news and how she had prayed for the family, and it turned out that it was her.
Yeah.
And then how she, Dora Lange, had this odd, or her father, they ask about her relationship with her father, and her father's now deceased, and they talk, and the first thing the mother asks is, why wouldn't a man bathe his own child?
Why wouldn't a father bathe his own child? Yeah.
Right, right. It's just the oddest thing. I mean, I thought that was such, I don't know. What did you think about that when she said that? Did you?
Well, the first thing I thought when I first saw her back then was that's Mrs. Pinkman. That's Jesse's mom. But yeah, well, that was weird. And then they had the picture of those horsemen with the girl in the Mardi Gras scene, the rural Cajun Mardi Gras scene.
I absolutely noticed that.
And
yeah.
Because that picture was like on her bookshelf, that was like an acceptable practice to celebrate Mardi Gras in that weird, crazy, dominant, submissive, whatever that is, people on horses with little kids on the ground, you know, scenario.
Was she a little kid in that? I couldn't tell.
It was a girl. It was a little girl, yeah.
Okay. I couldn't tell her age, but I did notice the masks and that they had it framed on the wall, and I thought that was really an odd thing for somebody to have on a wall, especially considering everything we know at this point about it.
Yeah, and we're going to see later, we find out some more about it, but there are replications of that scene in other parts of the show. Well, in a couple minutes later in this episode, we'll see some more of it, but I wonder why that's okay. You know, I guess that's just normal Mardi Gras remembering a 4th of July almost to those people.
Well, yeah, I think it's just the culture of the whole thing. And I think that's what it's opening up to us, a little piece at a time. This mother who's very ill and she has these headaches and they're talking to her. And Marty even comments later, they're in the car, and he talks about how his mom is like Donna Reed and how she packed lunches and bedtime stories. And Cole's sitting there looking out the window when he's saying this, and he asks if Cole's mom's still alive, and Cole says maybe, and that's the end of it. And of course Marty gives him this look, and I use Marty and Hart interchangeably in this. I probably shouldn't do that, but I think of them the same, you know, depending I guess on the situation. But his name's Marty Hart. But I think that just shows the difference in those two men, the way they were raised, and I think it gives us even more looks into their background, which I thought was a real interesting point that you brought up in about episode one, how the environment is as much a character in the show, the physical, the geological, the religious aspects, all that of the environment, and you know, even the theme song, when it comes on, their silhouettes show the environment and pieces of their culture, maybe, and religious ceremony and stuff like that as the show's coming on. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that it's a really super rural environment. It's like in the bayou swamp country, but chemicals, so like man-made aspects of what man-made society is, or how society, you know, makes its profit or makes its living or, you know, makes progress with technology, has totally invaded this totally natural environment, even to the point of Dora Kelly Lang, you know, Mrs. Kelly, whatever her name is, her hands are rotting away from chemicals that she worked with in a dry cleaning plant. And that's, I think that's just a smaller scale representation of like the other chemical invasion of this environment, which is like the oil industry and all the refineries and the, you know, the barges and ships and stuff. And we see that in some of those scenes when they do the opening credits.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely more, I don't know the word for it, but industrial kind of, I don't know. I definitely get what you're saying about that though.
Yeah. You don't see too many, like nice mom and pop businesses. It's like either brutally rural or brutally like industrial with this petrochemical industry invading it.
And see, coal's not from there. Coal's a transplant. So coal has a completely different background. He has a different internal environment than Marty does. This is Marty's born and raised. I mean, we assume. And they are just such different people. And it's interesting how, it's like you said when you did the first one, how they are almost perfect for one another in that the part that maybe one wouldn't get, the other does get. I think Cole's very intuitive and Marty's much more, I don't know, maybe pragmatic.
Yeah, so G&P, Gilba and Papania are interviewing Hart, and they're trying to indict Cole. They're trying to get him to spill some crap on Cole. And he doesn't really do it. He kind of protects him. And then so Hart and Cole go to meet Dora's friend Carla, and she's the girl with the stars on her neck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we'll start to see later on, you know, there's stars in the story of the whole Yellow King story and all that stuff. But she's the one that tells him about the church, the Spanish Lake Church. That
right. Well, the mom had mentioned the church. And then even the people at the mechanic tire shop that they interviewed, Dora's friends, you know, where she's at, they mention the church. It's mentioned again and again and again, but they're unable to find this church.
Right. So just that it's somewhere down south around Spanish Lake, and that's about all they know.
Right.
So they, I guess they start looking around and they start, they start talking about what, Cole starts talking about what Carla and Dora Lang were as friends and how they sound sad. Like, they both sound really sad. Like, people on their last legs and people who aren't, you know, doing very well. And they're just on the fringe of life, pretty much.
Well, yeah, Cole tends to really label people in those kind of terms. He labels the perpetrator as artistic and religious and... He kind of goes into this whole little speech about him. He has his ideas, I think, of how he sees how these people are, at least in his mind, and he gets a real clear picture of them, whereas Marty is just saying that he's seen tweakers do the same kind of gruesome things.
Right, it's a drug crime, and it doesn't really need to have this deep meaning that Cole's trying to inject into it. But it turns out Cole's probably right. I mean, she was an easy target for this person. And this person, whoever it was, had some sort of a deeper reason just than a drug, you know, like a drunken or high person just killing people randomly. It's like got more meaning than that.
Right. Well, and then they show that there's several days passing. And I thought it was interesting. Did you notice that, how they showed the days passing? Cole is sitting in his room and sitting on a bed staring blankly. Marty's at home and his daughters are opening the windows and there's giggling and sunshine's coming in. And then they flash back to Cole and Cole's lighting a cigarette. And then they flash back to Marty's house and his daughters are waking him, opening his eyes in the morning and stuff like that. And I think that's another way to contrast their lives and the places that they're coming from. And
yeah,
kind of showing that days were passing too.
In the after show, the producers and creators of the show talk about that time passing. And they say they made a point to make the pace of the investigation They made it apparent that the pace of the investigation is super slow. Like, it takes weeks and even months and sometimes even years for a police investigation to finish, you know. And they made a point of, like, infusing it into their lives, like the little girl opening Marty's eyes, you know, like he wakes up and first thing he's thinking about is the case again. And even to the point that, like, he's waking up with his family, he should have family time. But no, there's no family time. You know, this whole case has taken over all their lives.
Well, right. But with Marty, something's going to take over his life, whether it's the case or something else he's got going on. It seems like he's pretty uninvested in what's going on there. That's my take on that.
Well, he's got different needs.
I suppose. But finally, Cole breaks down. They're driving down the road, and Cole breaks down and tells Marty about being married for 3 years and that he had had a baby girl who died at 2 in a car accident, and how his marriage just couldn't hold up under the weight of that. And Cole didn't know at this point. And this is after the time's passed, and it's after the dinner that he's had at his house. And it's after a lot of time, and it's something that Marty didn't know.
Right.
And Marty was shook up. I think that's the thing about Marty. I sense Marty cares about things. He really seems to care about that situation.
Well, now you know he does for sure. And if you thought Marty was the murderer back then, this was the first crack in that foundation that, you know, he can't be that invested in kids or that affected by kids and learning of somebody losing a kid to go and then turn around and start murdering other kids.
Well, and that's just step one in it, because he shows time and again as the episodes progress that that's not his character in any way, to have the ability to hurt a child.
So these guys were both dads and they both had wives at one point. Why do you think Cole wakes up with the... he wakes up and says, my days are of nothing, and they're all like lost dogs. And Hart wakes up happy, playing with his kids and his wife, smiling next to him. How do you think they got to be that way?
Well, I think Cole had what do you want to call it, a tragedy, a stroke of bad luck. He had something hit him that just really significantly altered the course of his life, whereas Hart hasn't had that yet. Marty hasn't had that yet. But I think Cole has resigned himself, too. He even says, you reach a certain age and you know who you are. He lives in a little room behind a bar, and he works 4 nights a week, and in between he drinks. And he makes the point that there's no one there to stop him. You know, he goes on to talk about Lori, who was introduced to him by Maggie, who is Marty's wife, and how he almost married her, but he gave her cause and she broke it off. He takes blame and responsibility for the things he's done, but he thinks he's not good for people,
yeah,
is what he says. And I think he kind of withdraws because of that. But he says, you know, he knows who he is, and he said there's victory in that.
Right.
And I thought that was a real interesting statement.
So pretty quickly after that, Marty trades the happy family setting for handcuffs and whiskey for the court recorder girl.
Yes, he does.
He brings her the nice gift-wrapped handcuffs.
And he's talking about it. You know, he talks about it when he's being interviewed about how he has to... He rationalized it. Even in 2012, he's rationalizing that behavior in 2005, how you have to decompress before you go home. You can't carry this work home to your family and stuff like that. He's rationalizing this poor behavior. And then it flashes forward or backward to him... with the handcuffs with the court reporter girl.
Right. So I don't have the name of that actress, but back at the time of that episode, she tweeted out a message because that was about the time like President Obama had found out about the show and he was getting into it. And he's like, I'm going to make sure to watch True Detective tonight. And so she tweeted out, Obama saw my boobs.
Oh, my gosh.
Because that was the scene with Marty in the handcuffs, is her showing her boobs to the world. And then we're going to learn later on that she's kind of a righteous person. I mean, she stands up for herself. And people are making parallels with her and Skylar White in that, you know, she's like kind of a easy to hate person. If you pick a side in this and like think of what happened to Marty, and if you try to find blame on her, put blame on her, they were making parallels with her and Skylar from Breaking Bad.
Are you able to do that? Were you able to connect that?
Well, they're justified. They're both justified. Like, Skylar slept with another man to get even with Walt, but and so did this woman. She slept with another guy and then told, well, the worst thing she did, I guess, was to tell Marty's wife. But Marty deserved it. It wouldn't have happened without Marty.
Marty deserved it. But Marty's wife did not deserve it. It's like she didn't take responsibility for her own actions in that. It's like it was Marty's fault, and she was going to. But now, I mean, you know, the things that Marty did, he went pretty far. Not in this episode, but in another episode, he went pretty far in the situation. And I understand her anger at him. Well, I mean, I could understand her anger at him in this episode, but then she
turned around and she got Cole involved just to get back at Marty. So it isn't like a purely one person's guilty, one person's innocent. But I agree that Marty spun the whole thing to get it started out of its good place.
But he still this many years later, we're talking 7 years. No, many more years than that, from 95 to 2012, and he still justifies that. That's what I didn't like. But there's parts of him that you like, too.
So we see Cole's having these chemical visions, and then he's talking to P&G. I'm going to keep making sure I get those initials right. G and P, Gilbo and Papania. Maybe I should just say the names. G and P. And he has visions from high intensity drug trafficking, where he was probably doing what the drug traffickers were doing along with them to, you know, get infused with all these drugs, and they affected him pretty badly.
Yeah, and then he realizes that G and P, they don't even know what he's talking about, and he can't believe those files are still sealed, he said.
Right. So by talking about a little, he found out more about them. And he found out that they don't know about his time as Car Crash. You know, they used to call him Crash, but his name was Car Crash in that redacted file when he went undercover with the motorcycle gang and Ginger and all that. And we'll find out a little bit more about those guys in a couple episodes. But he was Car Crash, and they don't know that because it was still redacted.
Yeah, like you were saying, I think he is interviewing them as much as they're interviewing him.
Right.
But so, then it shows Cole pulling up to the hotel, and he's buying the Quaaludes from the girl. I suppose she's a prostitute, too, right?
Yeah, Lucy. I think she's the girl at the bar in the first episode where there was her and another girl.
I think so. I think she's one of them, yeah.
Yeah, and he asked her in that episode if she could get Quaaludes, and she wanted to sell them uppers because they were easier and cheaper, and that's probably what she had. But, yeah, this is Lucy, and I guess she was or is a prostitute and turned into a confidential informant for Cole. And she didn't really have much information for him. Just that there might be a place called the Ranch with this place where Dora Lang might have been or might have been connected to.
Right, but that was pretty good information. That information, once he got that information, it ends up leading him along the way. But I thought something, she was attracted to him. She was offering him more than just the drugs when he was meeting her. And she made a comment that he seemed dangerous, seemed like he might be dangerous or something. And do you remember what he said? He says, you know, of course I'm dangerous. I'm police. I can do terrible things to people with impunity.
Right.
And I thought that was pretty profound.
Right. So just like earlier in this episode where if you thought Hart was the murderer, you kind of saw a crack in your theory there that, well, he's looking like a pretty good guy. Maybe he's not a murderer. This is where Cole starts to look pretty good. Like, he could have taken advantage of her because she was, like, willing to have sex with him just like you said, she seemed attracted to him. She wouldn't even have him pay for it. But he turns her down because he's either not interested or it's really not the right thing to do to take advantage of her.
That's how I
chose to look at it, is he didn't want to take advantage of her.
That's exactly how I took it too. He looked at it like that would be taking advantage and that you should watch out for people who can take advantage of you, maybe.
Right.
That's what he meant by that.
So this is one of my first changes in my viewpoint of Cole, and that I started to think more highly of him, that he wasn't just like a down to the bones cop that would do anything to get anything done. He had a conscience.
Well, right. And he's definitely showing sides of himself that you can't help but like, even if you have to come. I mean, he's buying drugs from a prostitute. So it's hard to see that as a moral high ground in any way. But when she offers him more than that, I get the feeling anyway that he doesn't feel right about that. So it's interesting how they can take that and turn it into a positive for him, and something that makes him end up seeming more noble, I guess, than whatever.
Yeah, but he's just trying to buy drugs because he's tormented and he can't sleep. He's not trying to buy drugs so he can resell them or so he can plant them on somebody. He just needs
needs
his own sleep. So he's not really doing anything too bad, I don't think, by buying drugs illegally from a prostitute.
Okay. But then we see it goes back to Marty after this, and he's questioning the girlfriend, the court reporter, because she wasn't at home the night before when he had called her. And he starts giving, I just got it as just a, I mean, it was just such a blatant excuse. He's like, I just don't want you to go out. I don't want you to be out there. There's a killer out there. And that wasn't it at all.
He's just keeping tabs on her.
Yeah, and possessive, and wants her to be sitting in this apartment waiting on him to call. And it was just something that makes your skin crawl about him. You know, they make us like him, and then they make our skin crawl about him, and then they make us like him, and then they make our skin crawl about him. And I think that's one of the things that kind of keeps me coming back to it.
And then she kind of rises up, and she looks strong because she's honest with him. She's like, look, I can't meet a nice guy staying home all the time. I like you, but I'm looking for something more than just what you're giving me. So I gave her a lot of credit for that.
Well, right. She's honest with him anyway.
And then the next morning, he's mad at Cole because he figures out exactly what he's doing, that he's fooling around.
and it turns into a really nasty scene there in the locker room.
Yeah, but that was kind of good, too, because we see that Cole is tough, but he's right tough, like he's in the right. He can break Marty's hands when Marty's, like, ready to fight him for something where Marty's wrong about. And Cole just, like, respectfully and calmly tells him, if you can do this, but I'll break your hands if you keep doing it.
Right. And then, if you notice, I mean, you know, and what does he say? I don't even have it written down, but he said something at that point about if you need to have self-loathing, then I can... This is what Cole says to Marty. He goes, if you need to be self-loathing today, I can understand that, but we don't have to do. I can't remember, but I thought it was very profound, because that was what he was getting to with Marty. Marty was having that was where maybe that defensiveness, or maybe not, maybe he didn't have self-loathing, but he was certainly defensive over it. But when Marty walks off, Cole, I don't know if you noticed or not, I didn't notice it till like the second time I watched it, but Cole reaches up and like touches his neck like he's checking his pulse.
Yeah,
did you notice that? Wonder what that was all about. Like, he was so upset.
I don't know. Maybe he's just measuring himself. How did that experience, how do I catalog away this experience and how much did it raise my pulse. And
yeah, that was interesting to me that he did that.
He's like almost like a scientist exploring his own life, you know, like why do I think this way? Why do I, what motivates me to be like my pulse to race?
Yeah, maybe he was like biohacking his physical self or something. Okay, I can go with that.
So then they try to find this ranch and they follow up a couple leads. And one of the leads is this garage out in the middle of nowhere. And the two guys in there are like, oh, no, we don't know anything. So they get ready to leave. And Cole's like, well, hold on a second. I got to go back in. And he immediately whams the guy in the head with like a toolbox. So he's more right tough. You know, he's tough, but he's in the right. He's like, those guys knew what he needed to get, but they were holding it away from him. So he got the answer from them.
Well, right, and Marty's the one telling this story to the investigators, G and P. He's the one telling this to them, and he says that Cole seems to really have a knack for knowing what people know and what they don't know. And he did. He went back in there. I mean, it was like Marty was ready to excuse him. They both went in together and they talked to him. And the guys were like, we don't know. We don't know. And then they walked back out. And then Cole's the one that went back in. And, you know.
Yeah. I think Marty's about 50% of Marty is just like riding out his job, like collecting his paycheck. He's not as motivated as Cole.
Do you think? I don't know that he's not motivated. I think he just doesn't have the intuition that Cole does. So he doesn't necessarily follow the same leads that Cole does. He seems to really care about this case, and I think it really affects him. But he doesn't have the intuition to follow up on certain things.
Yeah, he needs more stimulus though than Cole, because he's ready to say, okay, we're gonna turn this over to the task force, honey, don't worry, I'll be spending more time at home. And but then when he finds out that what's really going on with these evil guys, he kind of gets really more
bothered. Yeah.
So anyway, they find the ranch based on what the toolbox to the head guy tells them, and they pull up and they pull in and they start talking to the proprietor of the ranch, who is this woman sitting outside on a couch, just living life large, I guess, in the bayou. I don't know.
And all the girls are posing as they pull up. Did you notice? It's like a group of young women posing for them as they pull up in the car. It was the oddest thing.
Yeah, but if you notice, did you listen to the comments? They were like, oh, those are cops. I don't want any part of that.
But they were still out there, you know, showing some leg, and I don't know. And, you know, Cole says, or they say, is this the Hillbilly Bunny Ranch? And, you know, and Cole's like, well, I got nothing against hillbillies. I don't know. It was funny.
Yeah. So they get into a little bit of a discussion with the head madam, I guess, and this other girl, Beth, the young underage prostitute, about who is a prostitute and who owns a woman's body and why can't a woman do whatever she wants with her body. That was pretty interesting.
It really was. He's Marty was the one that was very offended, or at least verbally, very offended that the girl didn't look 18. And so he says, you know, she's not able to make the decision whether she should prostitute herself or not at this age. And the head lady there, the head girl there, tells them, girls screw all the time for free. And guys like you, you know, don't care unless there's business added into it. And then suddenly you realize you don't own it like you thought you did.
Right. So that girl goes off and finds Dorling's diary and gets it for Cole and Marty, and they kind of part ways with the underage prostitute and the madam. And on their way out, Marty gives the underage girl some money and says, do something else. And as they get past everybody, Cole and Marty are walking out, and Cole says, hey, what was that, a down payment?
I know.
Which is pretty prophetic when we know what, as we find out what happens later on.
Right, and Marty says, you know, don't you know an act of decency when you see it or something like that. So.
Right.
But he was offended by that. That's
yeah. You know, I actually believe that Marty thinks he's doing the right thing when he's doing it, but he's got such low self-control of himself that, you know, when the opportunity puts itself in front of him, he succumbs to it.
Well, right, but with these younger underage girls, I think he's completely, I think he's serious. I think he means it, and I think his heart is in the right place.
Yeah, but still, he's victim to his weakness of whatever that makes him need this extracurricular sexual activity.
I suppose, but like I said, you know, you see him and you're like, yay, go Marty. It's a great thing. You know, I mean, he did this. He hands this girl money for nothing, tells her to get out of here. And because it's a horrible, horrible thing for a girl to certainly at least feel like she has to do that. And so you really feel something for him doing that. But then Cole brings you back to earth with it, you know.
Yeah, but it's superficial because he gave her what he had in his wallet, like, what, $80 or whatever. And then he goes on his way and that's the end of it. And then when he sees her again, if she's, you know, she's making him hot, he's going to like sleep with her. So he didn't go back. He didn't like follow up on her and go back and check on her and make sure she got away. You know, it was superficial.
I suppose, but what can you do in a situation like that? I mean, can you imagine everything he sees like that? He can't fix everything. And that was money out of his own pocket. I thought it was a kind gesture. I can't fault everything. Trust me, I find tons of fault with his character. But the things that are good, I can't find fault in them.
It's like giving a dollar to a homeless person, though. You go on your rest of your day. You don't start a fund or, you know, you don't start a charity to prevent more people from becoming homeless. It's superficial.
I suppose you don't, but at least you've given the dollar. And if it's given from a good place, then I think that means something. I don't know. I liked what he did.
Well, that woman actually became, you know, separated herself from prostitution by becoming a T-Mobile sales girl. So maybe it did turn her in the right direction a little bit. So anyway, we get to learn about a little bit more about the ultimate mystery here as they read Dora Lang's diary. And it's, you know, they see these symbols of the Yellow King and the crown and the stars and stuff. And so we start to learn about this whole Yellow King thing. And, you know, the Yellow King is a story by Robert Chambers in 1895. So it's way, way back. And it's based on all this mythology and all this crazy stuff. So why do you think this guy from 2014 or 13 or whenever he wrote this, Nick Pizzolatto, why do you think he's dredging up this old story?
You know, since you have told me, and you told me about this long before I, you know, saw this in this context, I really don't see a direct connection in it, only that it's stuff of horror and stuff made to really incite terror in whatever generation that it's in. But other than that, I can't find a connection. What's your connection with it?
I'm just going to guess because I don't know, but I think this writer, Nick, probably found this story somewhere along the way in his career, either in his entertainment or in his study of literature. And he probably liked it, and he probably wanted to give it some homage, and he probably wrote it into this theme.
Okay. I can follow that.
So this story is about this Yellow King, which in this old literature, it's a forbidden play if you read it or if you listen to it or hear it, it induces despair or madness into anyone who like becomes aware of it. And Carcosa, which we learn about a little bit more into the story, is this place in that fictional horror story. And Carcosa came up from an author called Ambrose Bierce in a short story called An Inhabitant of Carcosa from 1891. And it's just this crazy, mysterious city. But another thing interesting about Ambrose Bierce is he wrote a story called The Incident at Owl Creek Bridge. Did you ever hear of that?
Only when you mentioned it. I haven't heard from it other than that.
It's a story from, you know, like way back. And I don't know how connected he would have been to the Civil War. He probably was a little connected to it if he was in the 1890s somehow, his father maybe, or he was. But this incident at Owl Creek Bridge is about a rebel soldier who's captured by the Yankees, and they're preparing to hang him from a bridge over Owl Creek on this bridge, and he escapes. And I don't know if I should give a spoiler to an 1891 story, but they did a Twilight Zone on it. There's a 30-minute Twilight Zone on it, and it's really, really creepy story. He escapes. He's about to be hung. The thing drops. He drops. And the next thing you know, he's like in the creek, and he's like scrambling away and running for his life. And he runs down the creek into the woods, and he finds his family. He finds his wife, and he finds his daughter, and he's reunited, and he's all happy. And the end of the story has a really odd, weird twist, and I won't tell you what it is just in case you ever want to dig this up on YouTube and watch it.
I think I've seen it. I think I've seen most of the Twilights, and I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so it kind of turns out that, like, the whole as he's about to be hanged, he's fantasizing about, oh, my last minute of life, I want to just remember my wife and my family and my happiness. And then he feels like he's got a chance to recapture that happiness, and then the ending gives you a sharp turn. So I would recommend it. If you look it up on YouTube, you can watch it. It might be an hour. I think it's a half hour, but it's like the length of a Twilight Zone episode.
Is there any way we can link to that?
Yeah, I could probably find it and link to it.
Yeah, I think that'd be good if we could.
But that's the kind of stuff. So Ambrose Bierce wrote that story way back then. And somehow Carcosa has now worked its way into this Nick Pizzolatto tale that we're all watching as True Detective. And he's woven it into this group of people that somehow are, like, doing these crimes in 1995, 22, 2012, and all this. So.
And I've noticed that with each episode, they do connect more and more. Maybe not to the Yellow King. Well, some, yeah, but, you know, more. More and more so, stuff is revealed, I think, as they go along. But in this journal where they mention the Yellow King, the guys, based on her writings, they start thinking she's drugged. And they start hypothesizing about the drugs found in her system. Remember when she was found murdered, she had, what was it, LSD and was it meth?
Yeah.
In her system, and they hypothesize at this point, the guys, Marty and Cole, that she's being given these drugs and they're increasing them a little bit at a time. I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, and I think they were just going based on her writing, because it was seeming maybe more and more and more obscure or far out, I don't know. But in the box, they find the flyer about the church revival.
Right.
So.
It's made out of yellow paper, too.
Yeah.
So then we kind of cut back to Cole talking to G&P again about what happened to him back in his early days of his career. And we found out in 1993 he was in the Lubbock North Shore Psychiatry Hospital for 4 months. And that was right after his daughter got killed in the driveway on her tricycle, which we still don't really know exactly what happened. He just kind of says Sophia was on the tricycle in the driveway, and there's a really sharp bend in the road, and then blah, blah, blah. And he just kind of trails off. And then he says how he lost his wife right after that. She and he broke up like 3 or 4 months after that.
That they resented each other being alive.
Yeah.
That's what he says. I thought that was painful.
So he escaped into narco. He like took the narco gig as a cop, and he was said under that job, he was hitting it 24/7. So he's probably just getting really messed up all the time.
Okay. Now what I got from that conversation, tell me if I'm wrong, because I don't understand a lot of the lingo and stuff, but he says, after his daughter died and he and his wife were having this chaotic conflict and just, you know, as any parent would, he says he went wild and he says something about eight balls, which is some kind of drug, I guess, or something. I don't know.
Yeah, he was stealing drugs from the guys who was busting and taking them himself.
Oh, okay. Okay. And he says he emptied a 9 into a crankhead for injecting his infant daughter with crystal to purify her.
Right.
And that was what I got out of what he was saying. He said all this in like 5 seconds, and it was a lot of information, but he was saying that in order for him to stay out of jail, they gave him the option to go undercover, right? They kind of held it over his head, and he said there was no expiration date for that. So he was kind of, the way I took it, was forced undercover into narco.
Right.
Is that what you got?
Yeah, he emptied his 9 into this guy who essentially drugged his daughter, and you know, he shot his 9mm and killed the guy. But right. He became a floater for 4 years. So he was like, you're not really a cop anymore. Just go out into the world and become underground with these criminals, and then you can provide information for us.
Well, right. But then in February of 93, he said he killed 3 cartel men in Port Houston.
Yeah.
And then he said he took 3 25s in the side. I assume he got shot.
Yeah.
Is that what that means? Okay, and that's when he actually ended up in the psychiatric hospital, and they offered him the psychiatric pension, but he said no. He'd rather go on homicide.
Right.
And that's when they had sent him to Louisiana. So this whole big, huge snowball mess for several years is what led up, we find out right here, to him being put with Marty just 3 months prior to this murder happening.
Right.
So that kind of gives us a look back at his psyche and everything he had going on.
Yeah, you know, he said something about how he rejected the psych pension, which he says like jackpot, right? But he rejected it because of something he saw at North Shore Hospital. But I don't think he clarifies what he saw.
Oh, he did. He clarified. He said he saw a quote from Corinthians, a book of the Bible. And it's a quote that said, and, you know, he quotes it as saying, the body is not one member, but many. Now are they many, but of one body. And, you know, they're like, well, what do you mean? He said, I was just trying to stay part of the body. You know, but if you actually go into it, it's 1 Corinthians, from what I could find, 12 through 31, and it's a big long thing about how we're all, you know, one body, you know, so
yeah,
pretty interesting that particularly of somebody who, as we find out just a little bit later on in this episode, is not religious at all. Well, no, we found that out in episode 1, didn't we?
I don't remember.
I don't either. But anyway, the Bible verse is what got him.
So the next scene is the girls are fishing at Grandpa's house, and the family goes into this weird spin of not wanting to be there. And it was a really crazy scene, but it was kind of a hint, I think, to what we're going to ultimately find out in episode 8.
Okay.
You don't have any thoughts about that?
As far as what part are we talking about?
Well, the guy, the grandpa, you know, her dad, Maggie's dad and mom, and the fact that they even put this scene into the show, you know, that they're at the parents' house and they're not really getting along well, and the girls are in the boat, and the girls are kind of on their own too, which is kind of an important clue. I think they're separate from being part of the grandma and grandpa. They're just on their own. But anyway, it was a weird dynamic, and they get out of that and they go home, and then right before dinner, this is where Marty kind of overhears the girls, and he sees this weird scene that they set up with their dolls.
Well, right, but they're fighting before that, remember? In the kitchen is when they're fighting.
Yeah.
About, Yeah, I mean, that's where he's laying the guilt trip on Maggie, his wife, about how hard his job is and how she needs to be more understanding of him. And he starts really laying some things on her. He's sitting there, you know, knocking back the whiskey, and he's, you know, he says even her mother thinks she's a ball buster. I mean, just terrible things to say to your wife who's, you know, has this kind of relationship with her mother that it had just showed that's kind of at odds, and that his home is supposed to be a place of peace. And, you know, she's like, where did you hear that? Why do you think it's always supposed to be peaceful in here, you know, just for you? Like he's just kind of like you were talking about in episode one, like it's just a, like this whole family dynamic is meant to do nothing but soothe him and soothe his ego.
Right. Well, Marty always picks what serves him best for whatever he wants. He needs the mistress to make it a better family life, and he needs the family life to be safe and calm and peaceful, and it's all kind of whatever he gets the most out of.
Right. It's another make your skin crawl episode, because he really wants to lay stuff on this wife who at this point seems to love him and wants the family to work, and he is just really laying this guilt trip on her because she is not happy.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that he blows it. It's pretty clear that it's his situation to mess up, and he does. And I think this just reinforces that.
Absolutely. And so, then he goes down the hallway with the daughter.
Well, I told you once before that I watched this show with subtitles on, and you kind of laugh at me like, oh, you don't understand the Southern accents. But did you hear what he heard when he walked down the hallway?
Yeah, after you said that, I went back, and that's how I watched it, with subtitles, and it's great. Absolutely. That's how I completely have to watch it now.
Because this goes back to the grandpa's house, because the girls say, you know, they're talking to each other, not knowing that Marty's on his way down the hallway, or that Hart's on his way down the hallway, and they say, you don't have a mommy or daddy anymore. Yours just died in an accident. And you know they're making this up from something they heard. They're not creating this out of their own, you know, pristine little imaginations.
Oh, I know. I mean, where would that come from? These little sweet girls.
And it's obviously a threat. It's like they heard this from someone threatening another child that if you don't do what I say, you're not going to have a mommy or daddy anymore.
But why wouldn't he stand outside the door and listen to that conversation?
Because he's like he misses things right under his nose. That's been brought up before, too.
Okay. I would totally stand out there till that conversation died out. I would want to hear more.
He doesn't even look at the rape scene on the floor very carefully. He looks at it like, oh, well, that's kind of weird. Well, let's go have dinner.
Oh, I know. But the girls walk out, and there's a Barbie laying splayed naked on the floor with five Ken dolls in various levels of undress circling.
Yeah, that's her. All. So that, I think, all relates to the grandfather-grandmother scene with the girls in the boat and stuff. I think that's why they put them together like that, and I think that's the only time we've seen the grandparents in the whole episode, in the whole season, I think.
Okay, I didn't put those two together. That'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
So we got to kind of move along. We're at like an hour. So,
oh, I know.
So they're already back at the police department, and they start to meet this new task force of these three studs that come in. They're supposed to be the new, I guess, anti-religious task force pro-religious task force or whatever. And that the Marty and Cole have run out of time, and they have to like give it up to these new guys.
Well, right, and they introduce the guys. It's what's his name, Quesada, that brought him in.
Quesada, yeah.
Quesada, okay, that's the boss guy, and then he brings in Mark Daughtry, Ted Berthrand, and Jimmy Dufresne. Is that right? Yeah. So those names will. The last names of some, at least, will be important later on.
So I think we also see a couple of important points here, that G&P are bumblers. These two black cops doing the interview are kind of bumblers, because they press Marty about why Cole didn't want to give up the case, and Marty kind of protects him again. But then I think we if you don't know that they're bumblers then, we know that they're bumblers now from our seventh episode perspective. Because they drove right past the guy that we probably are seeing as one of the most important murderers in the whole thing.
Oh, my gosh.
But we won't spoil that too terribly now this early. But they're kind of skipping past important clues.
Cole's really upset at this task force. Marty's upset, but Cole's really upset.
Right. So we get to the next scene. We see Cole. They find the church. They go through and they ask a couple directions and they dig around a little bit. So they find the church, and they and Cole sees the spiral, the crows in spiral, the birds in spiral. Mm-hmm. So this is important to me to try to figure out, like, do you think it's real? If it's real, then there's some sort of mystical power in place. Because why would those birds be able to fly in such a perfect spiral to represent exactly what they're looking for? And if it's not real, then Cole's hallucinating.
So I don't think it's real. I never thought it was real. What I think it is, I think it's Cole's instinct that they're on the right track. Whatever he has, that sixth sense that he has to know this stuff and to feel his way through it, he gets his visions or his intuitions or his feelings, and that's how I took that.
Yeah. So either way, whether it is real or hallucination, Cole's admitting this honestly to G&P, the black cops.
Well, and he even says, he says something I thought it was great. He says, most of the times with the visions back then, I was convinced I'd lost it. This is when they're showing the birds flying in this circle of a stamp that was on this dead girl's back. And he says, but then there are times, and it, you know, he turns around and he sees inside this church, this drawing on the wall with the antlers. And he says, I thought I was mainlining the secret truth of the universe.
Yeah, I don't think he sees this drawing and thinks that. He thinks that about the birds in the spiral.
Oh, okay. I thought it was when he was looking at the thing. But
no, because that's real. That's a drawing. He's either lost it or he's mainlining the secret truth of the universe. It means he's like interpreting these weird signs. He's seeing lights and he's seeing the sun like way brighter than it should be. Mm-hmm. So he's either losing it, like he's lost his mind, or he's like getting some secret message from the secret truth. And then right after that, we see the two suns in the afternoon sky. Did you notice that?
I didn't notice that.
And here's the first stanza of the Cardosa. Or Carcosa, along the shore, the cloud waves break, the twin suns sink behind the lake, the shadows lengthen in Carcosa, and it's the shot of a bayou. The sun's like about to set, and it's so there's the real sun, and then there's a reflection of it in the swampy water, and it's two suns behind the lake. It's like a perfect representation of this King in Yellow Carcosa setting. So, did you ever believe, Michelle, that either Cole or Hart was the murderer?
No.
Or do you now?
No, I still don't. I still don't think that's how it worked out. I have saw too much good in both of them to believe either one of them were capable of doing this new murder. I'm got my head buried in the sand. I think I certainly do in a lot of ways, but maybe it's something I just don't want to see, but I still have much hope that it's neither one.
So there's some interesting trivia connected to the show. The title of the show is Seeing Things, and either the writer or the director said that that's what detectives are supposed to do. They find detail and discover revelations. But the task of the storytellers was to match what the detectives reveal in the show, in what we see as viewers of the show. So we never know more than the detectives do. We're in perfect synchronization with them as we watch the show.
Which is great.
Because some mysteries you know before, you know, the protagonist what's going to happen. You kind of know the answer.
I think that's interesting because it really does make the questions they ask more relevant, maybe.
Yeah. And then they also say that Cole has misanthropic tendencies, like he believes the worst of human nature, and that the Marty's just really screwed up. He wastes his family perfection to feed whatever demons he has. Like, for some reason, he needs to burn good things to find out more about demons and negative things. And that Marty has boundaries because of the environment he's in, but Cole has absolutely no boundaries. But even though Cole has no boundaries, he has a very strict code, like a stricter code than Marty does.
Yeah, yeah, and you see that more as it goes on, I think. I would agree with that.
And that,
but I guess he does have boundaries then. They're just self-imposed in place of societal or environment.
Well, he has boundaries even though he doesn't have to. Marty has to, theoretically has to, because he has a family and he's supposed to be, you know, loyal to his wife and come home to his kids, but he doesn't. And Cole has no boundaries, but he seems to have more, a stricter sense of code.
Yeah, and he seems to really care about the things that he does care about, the things that well, like you said, his code, more so than Marty does.
Yeah, and then they also said that McConaughey brought in the idea of the little mirror where you can only look in one eye at a time.
That is so great.
And that as a viewer, you're supposed to look at that, and then if you want to find meaning in it, you can, but if you don't, you can just let it go. It's up to you.
Well, I love that. But of course, I've kind of fallen in love with McConaughey anyway in this whole thing. He has.
So McConaughey brought in the little mirror, and Woody brought in comedy. Like, he brought in the, when he was in the bar telling his buddies about how he pulled over the girl for speeding, and then she went home with him, and then her roommate came home and stuck her finger in his butt. And he's like, I can't have sex any other way now.
No, that was laughing. Woody. That wasn't McConaughey.
I know. That's why I said Woody. Oh, McConaughey did the mirror and Woody did the comedy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Woody's got several things in there that are funny. And I mean, I really like him, too. He does several. There's several little comedy things, little jobs he throws in that kind of. There's nothing funny about this story. The story is dark. But there's several little things he says that kind of, I don't know, kind of brings it up just for a moment so you can catch your breath before you're submerged again in the darkness of the story.
So what do you think after watching two episodes of this? What is the meaning of this?
What is the meaning of this? I think at this point, we don't know. I think at this point, we only know that that the detectives are looking at Cole, and I think they're trying to put a case on Cole, but we don't know that even. We don't even really know that. I mean, we kind of know that now, but they don't.
I think we know. I think we know that they're wrong. Like I said before, I think they're bumblers. We kind of got hints that they're like, they look pretty smarmy and smug, like, oh, we're going to figure this out. We got you right where we want you. But they end up not knowing as much as they think. And I think my prediction, and I know up through seven episodes now, I don't have all the answers, but I have a lot of them. My prediction is that the only thing I really care about are Marty and Cole. Like, I don't care if they catch some guy at the governor's level and they put him in jail. I don't care about that. I care about what happens to Marty and Cole. And I think that's the payoff at the end of this whole ride, is what happens to either one of those guys.
Well, I think as we get toward the end and you see them working together again, and it's several years after they had the falling out, that at this point we don't know what the falling out's about. And it's pretty deep. But they're both willing to work together. It takes some convincing on both sides because of the falling out. But both of them really want the truth.
Know what the falling out is.
We know, but we don't know in episode two.
Yeah, but we're presenting this as, like we said, it's, we know where we are now. It's real time, so.
Well, spoil away.
But we do know. I mean, we do know. It's really not that important in the whole theme of the story.
It's very important because it's what caused them to break up. It's what caused the split in this team that ended up being, from what all practical purposes and everything we've seen up through episode seven, is a great team. They're horrible together, and it's like this conflict and this oil and water. But as a investigative team, we have Cole with his intuitions and all of his.
But we're gonna find out. We're gonna find out what happened, and we're gonna find out what happened in the mystery. And I think the real mystery isn't what happened in this crime mystery. It's what happens to these two guys.
Absolutely.
And so it doesn't matter why they broke up. I mean, it's good they got back together, and I'm guessing their teamwork together is going to probably solve this. But what really is the mystery to me is what happens to them and as people, this journey they're on, and why it ends up however it's going to end up.
Well, I guess we'll see.
So that's it for episode 2. Any last thoughts?
That was exhausting. This is not like doing a comedy, is it?
Yeah, we did too much probably about the scene by scene. It's good, I think, just because there's a million, well, not a million, but there's some other True Detective podcasts where they do reviews of the show. We did a pretty thorough review, and probably more reviewing than interpreting, but.
Yeah, but I think it's hard to. I think there's so much in each scene, and I don't think they put a scene in there that, well, maybe one or two, that wasn't completely relevant, at least to the episode, if not to the whole of the show. I think it's hard to leave a lot of that out.
Yeah, I guarantee you they didn't put anything in there that isn't relevant.
Right, so how do we not discuss what's relevant?
Well, the interpretation of why they did things without describing all the things that actually happened. I mean, we have to remember that the people that are potentially listening to this have already seen this. It's, you know, not like they just saw it. They saw it 5 episodes ago. So they're thinking back. They didn't just watch it like we did. They probably don't need to see the whole replay of it. You know, they just, I think whoever might be interested in this, like I was interested in like interpreting it, it's the interpretation more so than the recap.
Okay. I don't listen to it like that. I watch an episode and then I listen to a podcast about that episode, because I like to get every little bit out of the episode that I can, but I totally realize that everybody may not be the same way about that.
Yeah, well, that's good if it makes people go back and want to watch it.
It's there's just so much, so many little nuances of everything, and everything we've talked about in this hour plus that we've talked still doesn't cover many of the landscape scenes and the things that they've shown, which goes back to the industrialization of it and everything. I mean, just so much. They just put all this stuff in it that would take 2 hours or more to go over every bit of it. It's a lot of stuff, and it's perfect. I mean, everything about this show is really great. If anybody isn't watching, and I mean, I know people who are listening to us are watching it, but if anybody's not watching the show, they're really missing out, because it's right up there, I think, with Breaking Bad and House of Cards and I think it.
Yeah, not to mention even like all the mysterious stuff about the King in Yellow. If you want to go back and can read that literature, that was like the best-selling book on Amazon for a while. And Amazon even put up the book for free for a while. It may still be free, but it was one of the most downloaded books from Amazon.
Well, that's
and you know, so it wasn't the week before True Detective came on. It was like probably even unheard of.
But see, that is great. Maybe you can actually link to that too, and then the song, you know, the theme song to it, "Far From Any Road." It's by the Hanson Family. It's a Chicago band. It's a 10-year-old song that they kind of revitalized for this. And if you sit down and listen to it, there's so many different interpretations of even that song that it's. So there's just so much to it, so many little nuances to it, that I think it would be hard to do it without touching on them. But I'll try.
I give a lot of credit to the writer, and I guess the producer too, the director, for weaving all the scenes together in such a great way.
I mean, it's just perfect. It's perfect. And once you get used to how they go back and forth between 1995 and 2002 and all that, once you get used to that, it took me a couple episodes or watching this a couple times before I was really comfortable with that. But it really flows, and you're really able to gather a lot from that.
I think they go back and forth between 1995 and 2002 and 2012, and within the same time frame they go back and forth. Like in 1995, they go back and forth between stuff.
Oh yeah, they do. They jump around, and if you're really not paying close attention, you're gonna miss something. There's so much in it, and that's why I think watching it in closed caption, you were right. It's really good that way, because you catch a lot of the little jobs maybe and stuff that I wouldn't have caught.
Yeah, someone said that you can, like, the third time you watch each episode is like the best time, because you catch stuff and you see, like, you build up what you already know and you add a little bit more to it each time.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree. I think one last thing, and it's not really related to it, but you were talking about Maggie in the first one and how her and Cole's interaction and how Cole started to get some healing from it, or at least like a relaxation into a normal family situation, and how that was good for him and good for her and all that. And I just wanted to point out that I think that was, and I think you probably even said that, but I just wanted to tell you actually that I think that's what's missing in the relationship with her and Marty, is he has no real honesty in sharing things with her. There's nothing. If he tells her anything about what's going on, it's used as a dart or a bullet toward her. It's used as something to hurt her. At one point when they're talking, he says, should I tell you about the girl with the antlers on her head? He's not trying to share with her. He's trying to show what a great person he is by protecting her from this stuff. And all she wants is someone to open up to her and share with her. And that's what she gets from Cole when he starts talking about his wife and his daughter and that kind of thing. I mean, way back in the very first episode. And I just thought that was very telling, particularly as we go through more episodes and find out what happens between.
Yeah. We didn't talk about it in this episode, and it's probably important. I think it was in this episode where Marty asked why Cole didn't leave after he called him the ride, got him a ride home.
Yeah, he did ask that in this episode.
And then Cole just said something like, I guess I started to sober up, but he kind of brushes over it. But, he was, like, totally getting healed by the time he was spending with Maggie and maybe a little bit of Marty and the girls and stuff, but probably mostly connecting to Maggie and just talking and her talking to him and listening to him and stuff.
Yeah, and she was asking him the right questions and the things that he might not have wanted to share but needed to share. And he got that. He got kind of wrapped in the arms of family is how I took it. And it felt great to him in a situation that he hadn't had in a long time and wasn't sure he could handle if he did have. And I think he kind of has a feeling of protectiveness over Maggie. I think it's shown again and again, and he appreciates what she offers, and I don't think we see that very much from Marty at all.
Well, let's just hope he doesn't go crazy and try to mow her lawn or something.
Let's hope he doesn't. You never know, because, that's important.
All right, Michelle, good night.
Good night, Mike.